y'all can be seated. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Justice Darlene Byrne, and I'm here with my colleagues, Justice Baker and Justice Theofanis, and we welcome you all to the Third Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here today. As everyone knows, this matter is being broadcast also live on YouTube. It'll be available to you later via video as well as audio. So if you desire to look at your riveting presentations, which I'm sure they're going to be today, feel free to do the reruns. They'll be available for you. So hopefully we've got some, maybe 10 observers watching us today. I'm not sure how many may be watching, especially while we're also having the legislature in session yet again. This is today cause number 0322236CV, State of Texas versus Ellis et al. If I could have attorneys introduce yourself and state whether you're ready or not for this proceeding.
Philip Weinberger, on behalf of the State of Texas, joining me at council table is my co-counsel, Noah Reinstein, and the state is ready to proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Caitlin Silhan, on behalf of Appalachians, I'm joined by my colleague, Carl Siegel, and James Tucker.
All right, thank you very much. As you know, we have typically we give the appellant 15 minutes to open, then the appellee 20 minutes to respond, and then the appellant another 5 minutes to do rebuttal. As you'll see, we have our wonderful timing system that is so, you know, up to date here with the green light, meaning, you know, just tell us everything you want to tell us. At yellow, you've got 2 minutes, and then at red, certainly wrap up. And I will warn you, there are so many questions. So just, you know that we're there and have some interesting questions to raise today. But with that, I'll look forward to the appellant. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The state brought a TMFPA action against Xerox for alleged fraudulent schemes involving prior authorizations of orthodontic services for Medicaid clients. That action settled for $236 million. Subsequently, the appellees, who brought separate QTAM actions against hundreds of dental providers and Xerox, move for a joint share of that settlement in the state's action, claiming that it was an alternate remedy to their actions. Sovereign immunity, however, bars their attempt to gain a share of that settlement. And the TMFPA does not waive immunity for an alternate remedy under these circumstances. But even if it did, the state still retains its immunity because appellees' actions are not viable for the reasons that the state's action is not alternate to their actions, and their actions are not valid under the first to file bar and the public disclosure bar.
And counsel, on that issue, I mean, you've got obviously the two issues that you're talking about, but is the date on the first to file position the only issue, or is it the content of the pleadings that is relevant as well? And if so, with the relator's pleadings being sealed, doesn't that get past the sovereign immunity issue that you're raising in the first instance under the plea to the jurisdiction? Isn't that issue of whether they're first to file really a merits issue and not your argument on the initial jurisdiction issue? So that I feel almost like it's a circular argument that the state is making.
Your Honor, the first to file bar, it's our contention, is a jurisdictional provision, and that the first-to-file bar is a prerequisite to the suit. And we don't...
But how do you know who's really the first to file if it's sealed and nobody can see it? Even they're later seeing each other, so they have no idea whether what they filed is any different until you get past the very hearing you're trying to avoid.
I don't think, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question correctly, I don't think it matters that the relators can see what each other has filed. Mm-hmm. What matters is who was the first one to allege fraudulent transactions that the state proceeds with or seeks an alternate remedy from, and then we can then later determine whether, if the state proceeded with any of their claims, who was the first to bring that claim.
And has the state not already judicially admitted, if in fact the quotes in the appellant's brief on page 10 articulate that the Attorney General wants to reaffirm that he considers Dr. Christine Ellis a bona fide relator? Is that not a judicial admission in this case?
It's not, Your Honor, and it's not because when we're talking about bona fide relator there vis-a-vis Dr. Ellis, what they're referring to her as being a bona fide relator as to all the claims that she had versus the dental providers, not being a bona fide relator as to Xerox. The state never proceeded with Dr. Ellis's claims against Xerox.
Okay.
Can you address the point they made, or counterpoint they made, about conflating devices, conflating the two devices together on page 10 of their brief?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm not sure what they mean by devices.
Okay. The QI-TAM petition with the motion?
I believe what he's articulating is you've got a plea to the jurisdiction, which is the initial threshold of sovereign immunity, and conflating the issue of what is at stake in the overall scheme of a TMFPA anticipated future hearing for some trial judge to analyze whether, in fact, one of these relators is first to file or whether one of these relators has presented a different allegation related to fraud. I think that's the conflation that they're asserting.
I think I understand. Let me try and answer the question this way. This is a very unique case. It's unprecedented to our knowledge. And what we have here is relators who have each have a separate QI-TAM action pending. They are attempting to come into the state's action, to which they aren't parties, and they're trying to get a money transfer from the state. And in that situation, the doctrine of sovereign immunity applies. And they need to show that there is some waiver or exception to sovereign immunity, and they haven't carried that burden here.
But now they did bring their QI-TAM action before the state decided to seek a settlement, correct?
They did.
Correct. And in their role as a relator in a QI-TAM action, are they not themselves the state? And therefore the issue is the state is now going into the state's action asking for the state's component part, which is the relator's component part, because they raised these issues and brought these issues first.
No, they are not the state. When a QI-TAM relator brings an action, they, under subchapter C of the TMFPA, what they are doing is they bring it in the name of the state, and it's also in their name, and they can continue in the action. If the state intervenes and elects to proceed with the action, then the state takes over the action and it's primarily responsible. Or the state can decline to take over their action, and then the relators will continue proceed with the action on their own, but they bring it in the name of the state, but they're not the state. And the action that we have, that the state brought against Xerox was its own TMFPA action, and there isn't an XREL, if you look at the caption of that, there isn't state XREL relators. They're not party to our suit. And they, subsequent to the settlement, they come along and they want to be in the suit. They haven't even intervened in the suit. They're not party to the suit. They aren't the state. The state...
They're not the state, but they're acting for the state, right?
They would be in their QI-TAM actions, but they're not acting for the state in the Xerox action, that the state action that the state brought. They are strangers to that action, and they're coming in wanting to get a share. And we never intervened with any of their actions against Xerox. We intervened as to these relators and would have proceeded through some alternate remedies, administrative proceedings against the dental providers, but we never proceeded with their Xerox claims in their QI-TAM action. So they weren't acting as the state in pursuing Xerox, and they never did pursue Xerox in their QI-TAM actions. So to begin, the Section 36.116 of the Act unequivocally states that the TMFPA's QI-TAM provisions do not waive sovereign immunity, but for one exception that doesn't apply here. Appellees have cited no authority that contradicts 116's plain language.
And counsel, based on case law also, in your pleading on page, I believe it is 26, you assert about three or four cases on page 26 related to the FCA, which is the Fraud Claims Act, the Federal Fraud Claims Act, in which you say that TMFPA is somewhat like. In these FCA cases regarding precluding recovery of a relator share award by individuals who were not the first to file, you cite the Allergan case, the Endopharmacies case, and again an Endopharmacies case. In any of those cases, did the issue that you were asserting here, meaning they don't even get through the door because of plea to jurisdiction, or did the court actually go to the merits of an FCA to determine whether they were entitled to a recovery?
What the courts did in those cases is they looked to see whether there was a bar and that would extinguish their claims, that they didn't have valid claims because they were barred. I hasten to point out, Your Honor, that in the federal circuits, there's a split of authority as to whether public disclosure and first-to-file bars are jurisdictional provisions. The First, Second, Third, and the D.C. Circuit say it isn't jurisdictional, but the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Ninth, and Tenth say it is jurisdictional. So I'm not recalling exactly those cases at this moment as to whether or not they were barred because it was a merits or jurisdictional, but It depending on which circuit you're in, it's a jurisdictional.
And the Texas Supreme Court has not written on this.
No, this is a case of first impression, Your Honor. So despite 36.116, the appellees argue that 36.109 concerning alternate remedies available to the state is a waiver of immunity. The state, however, is not aware of any case, and appellees have not cited one, holding that 109 waives sovereign immunity. But even assuming for the sake of argument that it does, the state still retains its immunity because appellee's claims are not viable for three reasons. First, under 109, the state may elect to pursue a claim through any alternate remedy available to the state rather than pursuing its claim in a pending QI-TAM action asserting the same claim. If it does, the person bringing the QI-TAM action, quote, has the same rights in the other proceeding as the person would have had if the action had continued. But the state never elected to pursue appellee's Xerox claims in the state's action. Thus, their action is not an alternate remedy.
Can I interrupt you here? I was going to ask, do you agree that the state does not have a sovereign immunity claim for Alvarez's suit against Xerox?
We do not concede that, Your Honor. As to first to file, what we concede is that Alvarez was the first to file. But
Alvarez, so if we could have been litigating this case, if Alvarez were a party here, you would be arguing to us that the threshold question of plea to the jurisdiction, they couldn't even get through the door of that, and we don't even get to first to file because you've got sovereign immunity. And if that's the case, why do we even have the TMFPA, period?
Because in the typical situation, Your Honor, the state will intervene and proceed with a QTAM action, and in that case, the court has jurisdiction, and if there's a judgment or a settlement, the proceeds, the statute provides that they get a share. If it's an alternate remedy, the relators also get a share. But the problem here is it's not the state's settlement with Xerox is not an alternate remedy to their QTAM actions, because the state's action wasn't based on their claims. We didn't pursue their claims, so they can't be alternate.
But and aren't your claims exactly the same as theirs?
No.
Okay, and how so?
If Your Honor looks at clerk's record pages 276 through 323, that is the state's answer to a Xerox interrogatory number 3. And it, as that page range implicates, that is a long, detailed answer of what the state's claims against Xerox were. Compare those to the vague and general and basically useless allegations that the relators alleged in their petitions. And so if you look at our bench book.
And counsel, do we not have notice pleadings in this state?
We do.
And that's not adequate for a QTAM action.
It wasn't adequate here for several reasons, but if you look at those allegations, they are not the same claims that the state was pursuing against Xerox. And so if you look at that interrogatory answer and you compare it to our bench book tab B, and I see my time is running out.
Okay. Please finish that and tell me what your relief is, and then we'll turn it
sure.
over.
I would just finish to say that even if it were alternative, even if there's some overlap there, some slight overlap, there's still their claims aren't viable, and the state still retains its immunity under 109 because of the public disclosure and first to file bars. And so the relief that the state is seeking, Your Honor, is that the state requests that the order denying the plea to the jurisdiction be reversed and judgment be rendered dismissing Appellee's relator share claims.
Thank you, counsel, and my apologies. I know we ask a lot of questions and you probably didn't get to go through your presentation, but you've got good briefing. Thank you. Let me hear from the appellee. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Yes, ma'am.
Sovereign immunity does not apply to TMFPA relators' claims to statutory awards. And to the court's questions of my colleague here, no federal court under the Federal False Claims Act has ever analyzed a sovereign immunity issue. None has been raised to bar relators from receiving an award. The TMFPA, likewise, also provides that relator share awards are mandatory, and courts necessarily have jurisdiction to apply the provisions of the TMFPA regarding relator share awards.
And counsel, will you answer the question from your point of view about whether or not the state's claims are really the same as your claims, and but for your claims, the state wouldn't have had the opportunity to do the alternative relief outside of your QI-TAM claims case?
That's right, Your Honor. And one of the ways we know that the state's claims, that the settlement encompassed our clients' claims, and not just, to be clear, not just the appellees, but Ms. Alvarez's as well, is for at least two reasons. The first being that the settlement agreement with Xerox expressly resolved the relator's QI-TAM actions. Not only did it expressly resolve and pay the state for those QI-TAM actions, it actually also paid the state attorney's fees for litigating our client's QI-TAM actions.
And your clients asserted claims against Xerox?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
Because I thought I heard him say that they didn't assert claims against Xerox.
How did they give notice? How did they give adequate notice to the state?
Well, Your Honor, two points. First, I think the first to file jurisprudence, at least in the federal courts, which the parties agree is informative, at least, indicates that notice to the state is relevant. It's not dispositive. And we, all three of the QI-TAMs that were all on file before the state even commenced its investigation into the state's TMFPA allegations against Xerox, according to the express terms of the settlement agreement. All of those included allegations that were later restated in the state's 581 action. Relatedly, you know, our briefing goes into this in detail, but we explain the ways in which, in the course of litigating against the providers who sought to intervene in the state's TMFPA action, the state used our clients' QI-TAM actions as a shield against them, and actually represented to the district court in Travis County that the state's TMFPA action, the 581 action, was based on the earlier filed QI-TAM actions. So not only did the state's settlement with Xerox in the 581 action expressly settle our clients' cases, which is why we've filed the motion for a relator share determination. But they also, in previous filings, in addition to holding out Dr. Ellis as a bona fide relator, indicated that all of the relator's QI-TAM actions were the basis for and underlying the state's TMFPA action against Xerox.
So do you equate that statement by the state in their alternative claim as some type of judicial admission by the state, or what are your, and again, I refer back to your page 10 of your brief.
I believe that it is relevant to the course of the proceedings and to the reason why the relators have a valid claim for the court's determination of a relator share. It goes to the course of the litigation and why, contrary to the state's representations in this matter, why we understand, contrary to the arguments made here today, that Dr. Ellis did bring value to the state. I'd also like to note, despite what I heard argued earlier, it is clear that the state did intervene in Dr. Ellis's action, actually in LaFountain and Alvarez's actions as well. That was conceded at the plea to the jurisdiction hearing. That has been admitted and agreed to in the filings. I was surprised to hear otherwise today. But if the court consults the clerk's record, the intervention notice in Dr. Ellis's QI-TAM case is in the record. It's described in our briefing, and it is not qualified. The state intervened as to in the entire action. The state later, before it even filed its 581 action, moved to partially lift the seal as to Xerox and ACS to disclose the existence of Dr. Ellis's QI-TAM to ACS at that point.
Okay, so you're focusing a lot on Dr. Ellis. So do you concede that Fontaine didn't add anything extra, and therefore we should do as the state wants in Fontaine, but maybe Ellis stands in a little bit different light in light of the assertions by the state in the reliance?
No, Your Honor, and we certainly do not concede that. The specific representations that the court has inquired about that the state made below on page 10 of our briefing, those do pertain to Dr. Ellis, and that is why I emphasized those. But we do not agree that LaFountain is barred in any way. He added the unique allegation related to the activity-based compensation that went beyond. It was not stated in the first QTAM that was on file. It was a unique allegation. It was later pursued by the state in their 581 action. And again, all three of the QTAM cases at issue here were resolved by the settlement agreement, which is why we think it is appropriate for the trial court to determine the relator's entitlement to an award, given the state has settled their actions.
Counsel, I'd like to get an understanding of your position on where the state's coming from. They're asserting that you can't get through the door of the overall concept of sovereign immunity, that unless there's a clear waiver of sovereign immunity, you don't even get to the TMFPA claim at all. What is your argument that maybe TMFPA, the entire statutory scheme, is a waiver, even though it doesn't use the magic words, this waives sovereign immunity, mm-hmm. so that you get to that? That's one question. And then the other question is, are you arguing that because you're a QTAM relator, you are in essence the state, so the state is fighting the state in their settlement and how you divide the proceeds? I apologize.
Sure.
I hope those are clear questions.
They were, and I'll do my best to answer them in turn.
Yes,
with respect to the first question, we don't think that sovereign immunity applies to TMFPA relators' claims to a relator's share under 36.110. Because this is not like the cases in which sovereign immunity clearly does apply. This is not a claim for damages against the state. This is not like the Nazari case, where a TMFPA defendant seeks to offset a penalty that the state is seeking to incur. Instead, this is a statute with provisions, the express purpose of which is to allow trial courts to determine whether relators whose actions the state has settled, whether they are entitled to an award. We don't argue that there aren't statutory bars that could apply. Those are also in the statute. We think, like the trial court did, that the appropriate vehicle to raise those statutory bars is not a plea to the jurisdiction, because if there was sovereign immunity that applied to relators' claims to a relator share, the whole section on the relator share would be meaningless. It would be gutted if a relator could never avail herself of the trial court's jurisdiction
to
determine her entitlement.
In that regard, are you saying that the TMFPA's entire scheme in its totality is in fact a waiver of the sovereign immunity basis of law? You can't sue the king.
Well, we think that it is not, that it is outside the realm of sovereign immunity, but yes, if even if the court agrees that there is sovereign immunity in a case of a motion asking the trial court to analyze the factors under the TMFPA, that it would necessarily be a waiver. There's simply no way for a QTAM relator that the legislature has empowered not only to bring these cases in the state's name, which goes to your second question, but also to ask the trial court to award them a share of the recovery that their action, whether directly or indirectly, as was the case here, brought to the state. There would be no way to do that if the statute either was outside the realm of sovereign immunity or if sovereign immunity was waived by virtue of 36.110. Now, with respect to your second question, ordinarily these cases are when they're intervened, the state takes over the action and litigates them in the original cause number. In some cases, mm-hmm. when there are multiple relators, they're consolidated and litigated under that cause number. But there is the alternate remedy provision that allows, as the state did here, for the state to peel off and either litigate under a separate cause number in the district court or through an administrative action, which has also happened in connection with Dr. Ellis's case, for instance. And so in that case, the relator does not enjoy the right to take over the action and litigate it. The state does, but she retains her rights to seek the court's determination of the relator's share And of course, the state, you know, at that point is able to invoke the bars and argue for reasons that the share should be lessened or not awarded at all. But it's not a function of sovereign immunity.
All right. I don't know that I heard the answer to my question. Is, in essence, are the relators the state?
They are. Yes, they do stand in the shoes of the state. The statute empowers them and requires that they bring the action in the state's name.
Okay. So if the state's seeking a part of the state's recovery, how does immunity apply, if it does?
Right. I mean, I think that is certainly not... you know, not something. I'd be happy to provide additional briefing on that point. It isn't.
Oh, please don't.
Well, with respect to other aspects of the state's argument, I'd like to address those in turn. We think the state is wrong about the first to file bar, and in terms of Section 311.034 of the Government Code, we think the first to file bar is not a prerequisite to suit against the state. For at least two reasons, and this again gets to who's doing the suing and in whose name. The first to file bar applies to a relator's TMFPA suit, and those are by definition not suits against the state. They are suits brought in the state's name by a private party who's empowered to do so by the plain text of the TMFPA. Second, compliance with the bar cannot be accomplished before the later in time suits are filed. And I think case law is clear on this point, that a statutory prerequisite within the meaning of the government code is something that must be accomplished before the suit is filed. So, cases get into the example of post-suit notice versus a pre-suit notice requirement. The first to file bar necessarily requires that the trial court compare the pleadings, the key TAM petitions, and they can't do that if the later in time petition isn't filed.
So is it your position that the first to file bar is more than just the date, it's the actual content of the pleading itself?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and we think case law is clear on this point. It is the four corners of the petitions and the allegations stated therein that are compared. They don't need to be, on the one hand, exactly the same to be barred, but on the other, the purpose of the bar, as explained in federal case law, is not to immunize large companies from fraud liability by allowing the first-in-time case to plead something very general to bar later-in-time cases.
And counsel, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that in essence all three of these key TAM pleadings are, quote, in general fraud claims, and that they're really not talking about a different method of fraud? They're just kind of accentuating maybe a few unique facts, but the first in time was Alvarez, who did a general fraud allegation in which Ellis and Fontainer subsumed.
We vigorously dispute here, as we did below, that characterization of the three complaints, and we think it's clear that, and in fact, the state has conceded as to Dr. Ellis that she did state different allegations than Alvarez. She was the first to allege, not just as Alvarez did, that Xerox was approving claims for cosmetic braces, claims that didn't meet the severity score facially on the score sheet, but also that the claims review staff that the state required that Xerox use to approve prior authorizations and make medical necessity determinations, they weren't qualified to do that job. They weren't trained to do that job. So even if they were looking at a legitimate prior authorization request that met Medicaid criteria or met the Medicaid guidelines, That would still be a false claim. Xerox would still be failing its obligations to the state of Texas under its contract because it wasn't employing the right people to do the job. Relatedly, Dr. Ellis was the first to allege specifically that Xerox concealed all of this from the state. Both of those aspects of Dr. Ellis's allegations were separately alleged and resolved, settled by the state in its 581 action. Similarly, I already discussed LaFountain's compensation related allegation, the activity-based compensation, but again, just kind of stepping back, big picture, that allegation gets beyond approving claims that shouldn't have been approved to the payment, the improper payments of the people doing the review work, another way that Xerox was failing its obligations to the state. And I'd like to just, unless there are questions, just quickly point out that if the state were right, then the whole incentive structure of the TMFPA would be frustrated because the first in time whistleblower could just file a bare bones complaint alleging general non-compliance on the part of a contractor with Medicaid requirements writ large, and they would bar later relators who have more detailed allegations that could actually put the state on notice or empower the state to investigate and pursue more detailed allegations, or allow them to investigate and pursue in the state's name those detailed allegations.
It would complete. My apologies, please finish your thought there.
No, I can be done.
Okay. As it relates again to the sovereign immunity issue and being a door through which you have to get to even get to TMFA, are the relators arguing that because the aspects of the TMFA raise fact issues, such as are they the first to file, are there differences in fraud claims, blah, 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 does that, if there is a threshold issue of sovereign immunity that you have to chomp off first, is it the fact that the TMFA structure itself inserts fact issues preclude a plea to the jurisdiction grant and get you to the hearing, at least on TMFA, because you've got fact issues to address?
I think so. I think if the court is inclined to to say, that there is such a plea to the jurisdiction window that we have to go through, that certainly,
Yes, ma'am, please.
That certainly those issues would remain and require the trial court's finding before a determination can be made.
Thank you.
I see that.
And I know you're running out of time, so if you feel you have other items you have not yet addressed.
I don't. I would just like to leave for the court with this. This is an important case. If the state's arguments are accepted, it would gut the relator share provisions of the TMFPA and remove the legislature's incentives for relators to come forward and report fraud to the government. We pray that the trial court's order denying the plea to the jurisdiction be affirmed.
And
thank
you. Before I let you go, I want to ask my colleagues whether they have any questions.
I just wanted to ask one little detail. What is the best authority that you have for your position that the first to file bar is not jurisdictional? Where would you point us to look, first and foremost?
The Millennium Labs case that's cited in the briefing, I believe that explains a little bit about the circuit split and why it's not jurisdictional. If I may have 10 seconds to explain. The Federal False Claims Act did at one time have a jurisdictional bar in the public disclosure bar. The TMFPA has never, to my knowledge, used that wording. So the court in Millennium Labs explains that Congress knows how to insert a jurisdictional bar when it wants to. It didn't do that with the first to file, and it's not written in jurisdictional terms, is how I recall the court explaining that, and I think that reasoning applies here.
Thank you, counsel.
Just to summarize, if this is fair, your principal central point is if we were to rule for the state, that we would be undermining this law for other relators to come in the future. Is that pretty much the linchpin of your argument?
It is, Your Honor. And if I would just add one additional point, it's that there are already mechanisms for the state to raise first to file and other bars against these relators or other relators. It doesn't have to be by invoking jurisdiction, but by invoking sovereign immunity, rather, it does have the potential to completely gut the TMFPA and the incentive structure the legislature put in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
And now let me hear the rebuttal.
I have 5 minutes, so I'm going to try and tick off these rebuttal points quickly, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
First of all, my friend on the other side says that relator shares are mandatory, but that's only true if the claim is valid. Our assertion here is that they don't have a valid claim to a relator share. I also thought I heard my friend on the other side say that Section 36.110 is a waiver of sovereign immunity. Look at that language in there. You will not find any waiver language in that provision. My friend on the other side also pointed to statements that state's council made, and basically implying that the state's actions in making those statements were somehow a waiver of our immunity. But as this court well knows, that the Texas Supreme Court has never recognized that there is a waiver by conduct exception to sovereign immunity. And furthermore, only the legislature can waive sovereign immunity. An assistant attorney general can't waive sovereign immunity. They also put a lot of stress on the fact that I think my friend on the other side misunderstood what I was saying. They make a lot of hay out of the fact that the state intervened. We acknowledge that we intervened in their actions. What they miss is the state didn't proceed with their actions against Xerox. We had our own action in the state action against Xerox based on our own claims, not based on their claims.
So you didn't assert that they fraudulently submitted claims. You didn't assert that they had ill-equipped employees reviewing. You didn't assert that they were paying them in such a way that would incentivize the employees to do more claims and not really look deeply at the claims. You did not none of those assertions that were asserted by the relators?
Basically, I'll stand on my earlier answer. Compare what we told Xerox our claims were with what they're saying.
And so the interrogatory answers versus pleadings.
They may have, and this is where the public disclosure bar is a big problem for them, all three of the relators, is because what they're alleging was already in the public domain. There was governmental investigations, there were audits, there was news media, there was, and the whistleblower who brought the whole scheme to our attention wasn't one of these relators. And that all happened 2 years before they ever filed their lawsuits.
But isn't that something that the trial court looks into in the TMFA part of the claim of whether there was public disclosure, whether there was copycat? Isn't that what happens once we get into the TMFA?
Well,
and isn't that a merits argument?
They're alleging a waiver through 109, that it's an alternate remedy, but it's clear, Your Honor, in the sovereign immunity context, but also in the federal false claims context, that they need to have a valid claim to be able to say that it's the state's alternate remedy entitles them to a share. They don't have a valid claim, and they don't have a valid claim because it's a public disclosure bar, which means that needs to be addressed. as a jurisdictional issue. And it doesn't matter that the jurisdiction might touch on the merits. The Texas Supreme Court says that's okay. The court should just go no further than necessary when deciding the jurisdictional issue. And that's what we're saying here, Your Honor, is even if you don't agree with us that you think it's an alternate remedy, their claims still aren't valid because of these two bars. And I really need to mention that there is a way for them. They say, oh, this is going to blow up the whole statute. Relators will never be able to get a share. They're hyperventilating about this, but there is a way for them to get their share claims heard. They can each seek a share in their own QTAM actions. That's the way it's usually done. The government over here settles it, and in their QTAM actions, they tell the court, award me a share because the state went over here and did this. But that's not what they're doing here. They're coming into our action, which they are barred by sovereign immunity. I see my time is up. I have one point I would ask
the
court.
Please, counsel.
They bring up the settlement, and I think this is very important. They basically are saying that the settlement entitles them to a relator share because of what the agreement that the state worked out with Xerox. If you look at the clerk's record at page 36, that's the settlement agreement, paragraph H on that page. It does say that with respect to the related actions or any QTAM actions that are out there, those are being settled. But it says the state and the defendants agree that the state shall be solely responsible to reimburse any relator for any amounts pursuant to provisions of state and federal law. So if basically that's telling everyone that the state is solely responsible to work out whether they are entitled to a share pursuant to state law. We're saying they're not entitled to a share pursuant to state law. And the settlement agreement also says that the state will commit to resolving what the share amounts will be. So, and by resolving, that means that by having that language in there, it is telling everyone that the state can dispute whether or not they have a relator share. The settlement does not say anything about awarding relator shares, only that the state shall determine whether they're entitled to a share and resolve it with the relators pursuant to state law.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing this interesting issue to the court. I just want to make it really clear that I've been doing this kind of work for 23 years now, and this is a very unique and very important case, no doubt, and we will work on it aggressively and deliberately and do our best to get it right for you. And it saddens me that in a year I won't be able to preside over these cases again. But that is the wisdom of our Texas legislature. With that, this case is submitted. Thank you.